Whose tongue outvenoms all the worms of Nile? William Shakespeare. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. Maybe quite a large number of you are joining me this week for the first time, or maybe for the second time. But regardless, if you're new or returning, welcome. This month, May, has been extremely busy for the show. This is already only two episodes in, 19 days, become my most downloaded month ever, by a decent amount. And it's only going to get better from here, I'm assuming, unless no one downloads for the next 14 days, which is, 12 days. Which is, I guess, always a possibility, but I doubt it. So thanks, everyone, for helping the show continue to grow. To that end, I do want to try to do a better job of reminding people of an episode's time period. Just so if they are joining for the first time, they know that, hey, I've talked about some stuff that's happening in the past prior to this, and just know that this is not necessarily a whole view of what I have said in the past, and that you may be missing some context, so that's part of the reason you should go back and listen to old episodes. But this week, we are going to be talking about people living in the region around Lake Chad, the Central Sahara, and the central and eastern portions of the Sahel, and the river valleys and rivers that come together to form the Nile. And this is all taking place between 6,000 to about 4,000 BC, BCE, whichever you would like to use. And we'll probably be here for 2 to 3 episodes, and then we'll move east kind of into the Horn of Africa region before we move to northern Africa. Now, unlike Western Africa, there's a little bit better archaeological record. This is partly due to the environment being slightly less tropical, and also probably due to an earlier switch in lifestyles that we'll get into. Now, there's also the linguistic approach that is a little bit more complicated than what we dealt with in Western Africa. I believe I mentioned back in either last season or season 2, and I may not have even brought it up at all. I think I did. But Joseph Greenberg, who is, again, one of the more prominent linguists of the last half of the 20th century, he had made some very large kind of in-depth studies and hypotheses, I guess, about a number of languages and language families. And he developed a number of classifications from these. Now, while some criticism exists for some of the languages he included in his Niger-Congo classification, by and large, it is generally accepted by most linguists. The same cannot be said of his hypothetical Nilo-Saharan language family. It is much less accepted, and indeed is very widely criticized, with some referring to it as his trash bin, saying essentially that he stuck everything that didn't fit into any of the other African language families together. The reasons for this are manifold, but this criticism, saying it's his waste bin, is a little bit hyperbolic, I think. And as time has gone on, people have reflected on his reasoning, and the criticisms have been toned down. Now, people still disagree with him, but some more testing and research show that it might not have been as landish or outlandish as a hypothesis as some of his critics initially believe and made it out to be. Though, again, they still disagree. And there are other ways of explaining some of the similarities that Greenberg found. Things like maybe the supposed branches had been, you know, they adopted some aspects of each other's language just from being living so close to each other for so long. Or, you know, it could just be a coincidence. That does happen. But research is ongoing, and other classifications are being explored and have been laid out as well. Of course, regardless of how or even if the various language of Nilo-Saharan are actually related to each other, we can still use the constituent groups to gain some understanding of where they were living and what they were doing at this point in our timeline. Before we kind of dive into that, you may occasionally see some older kind of ethnographic studies and even some modern ones talk about the Nilotic people. These are people living in what is now like the Sudan, the western part of Ethiopia, all along the various like Nile tributary valleys, referred to as Nilotic peoples. On average, they tend to be taller than most other people. As a group, they are kind of the opposite in some ways to the pygmy peoples of Central Africa. They also tend to have, on average, darker skin than even other parts of Africa. With, I think it was the Egyptian writings, even referring to them in some cases as being gray-skinned. So just keep that in mind. That's obviously not 100% accurate, or it's not 100% the case that they're all taller than everyone else, but there are groups of peoples in the Nile, kind of the Nilotic kind of region, that are on average taller than most other human groups. So you'll see that brought up in a number of places. Now, like the pygmies, when this kind of evolution happens, or when this stature, I guess, is more commonplace, is a matter of debate. Though I think it's probably safe to say this might be a little bit earlier than the time period we're dealing with, but just keep in mind that is something that is happening or has happened up to this point. Now, a lot of these groups are semi-nomadic pastoralists. They become very prolific herdsmen and hunters, even into the modern day, Maasai in Africa. They are Nilotic peoples. They still practice lion hunting, believe it or not. And in some cases, hunt them solo. Now, that is not regularly done, at least these days, because, of course, lions are endangered. There are a lot of groups trying to protect them. But by and large, the Maasai in the past, and even today when they do hunt it, it is something that is done very ritualistically and only done in very small amounts. And it is done with traditional methods, spears, and in groups. They do not use guns to do this. It's part of their initiation rituals. But again, that's a modern group. That's something that happens, very rarely these days. But it is still done. In fact, you can find some very grainy footage, but you can find some footage of it being done. They use what's called an impikas, and that may be a little bit more of a Greek pronunciation on that. I do apologize. But essentially, it's a lion hunting delegation. And they will do this for a few days out of the year. And in some ways, it's kind of a secret ritual, like how it is done. Is a secret to these people. Like they don't give out the secrets to anyone outside their group about what they do and all the rituals involved. In fact, it was so secretive that they wouldn't even fill in younger warriors and hunters about the plans for the hunt. They would kind of keep it among the mature and more, I guess, seasoned hunters and warriors. Now, again, this is something that's going to happen in the future. The Maasai probably aren't, well, I'm willing to say they are not a firm group at this point. Their ancestors may not even be in the region where the Maasai live, which is a little bit south. They live mostly in today in what is Kenya and also in Tanzania, excuse me. And I think today there are around 2 million Maasai, give or take. Now, for the Nilotic peoples, they are probably at this point mostly concentrated around, again, the southern tributaries of the Nile, as they're all starting to flow down downhill, and then right up until the area where they meet and form the Nile, and then they're up to, I think it's the first cataract of the Nile. And I did go over the Nile in the past and how it is divided and how it is formed. I think that was in season 2 when I discussed that. And honestly, they were probably north of that as well, especially at this period when obviously there are no borders. And even in the historical period, once Egypt itself has formed as a state, again, there are no like firm border controls and things like that. So there was probably some overlap and migration into and out of the region by Nilotic people. And there is, of course, evidence of them interacting with the peoples living in what is now Egypt. And they probably were heavily involved in all manner of interaction with the kind of the proto-Egyptian cultures in the region. They would have traded, they would have fought on occasion, any and all kinds of what you would consider standard interaction between human groups. The Nilotic peoples around the Nile would do that with not just the neighbors, but also themselves. Another kind of concentration of Nilotic peoples is happening around the Chari River. That is the river, and it's not just one river, but it's a kind of a river system that feeds into Lake Chad. So that's kind of the heartland of the Nilotic Nilo-Saharan groups. And, of course, they were north into the Sahara, which, as we talked about with some of the West African groups in the previous couple of episodes, the Sahara is still green, though it is beginning to desiccate quicker and quicker. And that probably is one of the reasons that will lead Nilotic groups to spread further south and to their west, which, again, they were probably traveling there anyway, but because of the desertification, they are expanding where they're going in terms of south and west, and maybe east as well, though they probably didn't get too deep into the Ethiopian highlands, the Horn of Africa area, partly because they probably didn't like the terrain, and also because of the people living in the highlands being more ensconced. Of course, it's harder to travel through mountains, and especially if you're faced with people who are, shall we say, very protective and insular in their territory and range. Of course, with the Nilotic peoples occupying these kind of areas between the Horn of Africa and the northern part of the Nile Valley, they are very well suited to be intermediaries and control, or at least precipitate a lot of the trade in the region. That is something that they will do throughout history. And even they'll also precipitate trade to groups further to the west once they meet up and, you know, firm trade links are established. They kind of play a very important role as middlemen and brokers, not just of trade, but also protection. They will, you know, kind of take their cut from any type of trade coming through the region. And in some cases, different Nilotic groups kind of form almost an elite in certain societies that they are not necessarily indigenous to. They become kind of almost like a backbone of a warrior class, in some places ruling classes, and things like that. But again, that's well in the future. Now, I don't believe I ever went over etymology in terms of the names of the Nile and the Chari. Now, the Chari River, I could not for the life of me find any etymological source on the name. It may be Nilotic, some Nilotic language, but it's not mentioned in any of the encyclopedias I read, or it's not even, like, guesses aren't even made in terms of like Wikipedia, which occasionally has, you know, etymological histories, or at least popular stories of how they got their name. Now, it could be related to the Arabic Sara, which means pleasant, or I think delightful is another translation I saw. There is a town, or like a, I guess a capital, like little city in the part of modern Chad. Though, from what I could tell, it appears the city got its name from the river. It was actually not built until, at least from what I saw, it was not built until the French arrived there. It used to be called Fort Achambault. And once they left, they renamed it to Sar, which in Arabic is Sara. Now, Arabic will eventually become an important kind of like intermediary language between some of these different Nilotic groups. But I didn't see anything about the river getting its name from Arabic. There was nothing listed about that. So it may have just been, well, Sara is close to Chari. Chari means pleasant. The river's pleasant. Let's call the city Sara. But in terms of the name, I don't know the origin. I could not figure that out. That may just be one of those linguistic coincidences we've talked about. Now, the Nile comes, not surprisingly, to us from the Greek Nelos, which got taken into Latin as Nilus. And, of course, that came to the other European languages. But it is believed that the Greeks adopted it from a Semitic word, Nahal, which literally meant river or river valley. Now, the Egyptians themselves, they did not speak Semitic languages. Egyptian was, though, in the same macro family. They referred to the Nile as the Ar or Our. It's kind of hard to tell what the, because like the Semitic languages, the Egyptians did not write out vowels. They just have the consonants. But what that meant was dark or black, and it's thought that that referred to the mud and soil that the Nile would leave behind, this dark, fertile soil that the Nile produces. That's where the name is believed to have been applied, I guess, for the Egyptians. the Coptic language, which is a descendant of ancient Egyptian. They refer to the river as, Iaro. So it's a little bit kind of elongated, I suppose. Now, the two main tributaries of the Nile, the Blue Nile and the White Nile, I could not find a firm African language name for the White Nile. In Arabic, it's referred to as An-Nil al-Abyad, which is literally the Blue Nile. Or, I'm sorry, the White Nile, excuse me. And I'm sure I butchered part of that. Apologies to all of my Arabic-speaking listeners. Now, it's possible that there was another name for the Nile that was just directly translated into Arabic. And again, because of some of the Nilotic peoples using Arabic as kind of like a trade language or a language for communicating with the outside world, they may have just, it may be a direct translation, but I do know that also that at least in southern Sudan, the part of the White Nile that flows through there is sometimes referred to as the Mountain Nile or Bahr al-Jabal. So that's what I could find for the White Nile. The Blue Nile, though, which rises in the Ethiopian highlands, that does have an some names from a language that is native to the area. In Amharic, it is referred to as Te'ekuri Abayi. And apologies for, again, the Amharic pronunciation. There is no audio that I was able to play to try to even get close to the pronunciation on that one. Another term is from the Oromo language, where it was referred to as Mormor or Abaaya, which I believe translates as actually father of streams. Of course, the Arabic for it is An-Nil al-Azraqu, I'm sure I butchered that. And that, of course, means the Blue Nile. And none of these languages, are part of even the hypothetical Nilo-Saharan language. So just keep that in mind. I'm just going over them because it is part of the etymology of the Nile, and I have skipped that river in the past, so I wanted to make sure I covered it again before I forgot it. Even if the Nilo-Saharan language as a whole does not exist, we can at least say, with reasonable certainty, that at least some of the subfamilies under it are related to each other, and that they do have some types of connection. Now, if we go by this, the standard, I guess, linguistic axiom that the area that sees the most diversity in a language is generally the area that it began, and then, of course, as you get further out and you find less variation between, areas, it's a newer place that language has appeared. So, looking at an overview of what could be Nilo-Saharan languages, the biggest areas where you see the most branches or subfamilies or just areas with the most linguistic diversity, you see two areas that kind of take center stage. Those are in the Great Lakes / Great Rift Valley region of Eastern Africa. So what is now like Southern Sudan, Ethiopia, the Congo, those areas, and I mean the far east of the Congo, the Great Lakes region of Africa, essentially. And then you see an area around kind of towards the east of Lake Chad, where there are a number of smaller rivers just south of what is now the Sahel and the Sahara going further north. So it's in those regions that we're going to focus on next week and talk about what people were doing at that time, and maybe ancestors of modern groups in the area. But it's important to remember that at the early stage here, there are, you know, there is an expansion of lifestyles. It's not just hunter-gatherers in this region at this point. There is an expansion of herding from animals coming from Asia, coming down the Nile Valley, goats, possibly cattle, sheep, things like that. And then in Ethiopian highlands, you have people developing their own crops native to the area, which we've talked about in our special on agriculture. And of course, crops are coming down through the Nile as well. Now, not all of the Nilo-Saharan people are, as I said, they're not all hunter-gatherers anymore. They're not even all pastoralists. There are some groups that are probably becoming agriculturalists. And there are going to be Nilotic peoples who do practice agriculture primarily. Even those that do, though, still practice a certain level of herding and hunting and gathering, but it's no longer their primary lifestyle. And we'll dive into, again, specifics on that next week. But for now, I think this is kind of a good point to stop. That'll give me time to kind of dive in. I think there might be... We'll see how much I get to research. But I will say that they are... in the Neolithic period, at this part of our episode, firmly, they still may be developing new tools to help them with their agriculture. Yeah, they are firmly in the Neolithic and have been for a little while now. They are early adapters of like the microlithic blades in Africa. And they may have done it independently. They may have gotten it from groups further to the north, migrating into the northern Nile Valley. It's hard to say. Also, a possibility, and I mentioned this in the animal domestication, some of these groups could have been the ones domesticating the donkey on kind of the western edge of the East Ethiopian highlands. It could have been done by peoples living in the Ethiopian highlands. It's hard to say for sure. Donkeys, smaller herding animals, are what they have at first. I don't know if cattle had gotten this far south for sure. I think definitely probably by the end of the season, cattle are definitely starting to come in, though I'll have to double check on how widespread they may have been. I don't know if they become like one of the big cattle culture areas until after this season begins. But cattle culture does play a big part for some of these groups as well. And that's, you know, that's not solely the domain of the Nilotic peoples, but they are very big proponents of the cow. And that's all stuff that we'll talk about later. I think this is a decently lengthy episode. I don't want to kind of just rush everything and give you guys like maybe like a 20-minute episode now and a, you know, 40-minute episode next week. I'd like to at least try to keep it 30-30 or close enough to it. But like I said, I think it'll be two more episodes talking about the Nilotic peoples and this region. And then we'll move on to the Horn of Africa and then north. Now, as for next week, in the States, it's Memorial Day next Monday, so a lot of people have work off. I do. I am still going to try to have the episode out at the regular time. I will be doing some traveling, but I do plan on bringing my computer and doing the recording at the location I'm traveling to. It may be delayed a little bit. It may not be up first thing Monday. I'm going to try to have it out there, but if it's delayed by a day or two, don't panic. Just let you guys know ahead of time. Please feel free to leave any comments or send me an email. You can reach me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on Twitter or X. You can comment on my YouTube videos. I may not get to them immediately. I had some feedback on an episode from a couple of weeks ago that I did not get till kind of the mid part of last week. I don't always see those comments, especially if people don't have like a notification set up. But I do try to respond to them in a relatively quick period. Of course, I also live stream on YouTube most days during the week, Monday through Thursday for sure, occasionally on the weekends. I just had a very long and fun game playing as the Inca in a game, and I think I did a pretty good job of it. And I'll be back tomorrow starting a game. I think I'm going to be playing in kind of the northeastern Eurasian steppe as one of the Jurchen tribes, trying to form the Manchu and then the later Jin and then into Qing. So I'm looking forward to that. And if you see I'm live, feel free to drop by in the chat, say hey, ask questions there. I can answer all your questions live. I'm happy to do so. But yeah, and we're up to over, I think, 130 subscribers on YouTube, which is cool. And as I said, May has just been a huge month in terms of downloads. I'm wondering if I might hit 500 for the whole month, which would be great, especially if we can start getting it consistently. Now, that's a lot to ask, I know, but it's very heartening and very encouraging, and I thank you all for your support and your continued listening, and thank you all. I hope you have a good rest of your week and a good rest of your day whenever you're listening to this. Thank you all. Goodbye.